Welcome to Philosophy 202, Theories of Knowledge. Let's see, first things first, who here present in the classroom wishes to add the class that is not yet enrolled? Okay, only three. That's actually pretty good. Four. I'm going to send around a list, so if you'll put down your name and your L number, I will put you on the list, and I think we may be, we'll almost certainly get some drops. I do have a short wait list. It's actually not as long as before. Usually, like in fall term, I had, I think I had 12 or 15 names on my wait list. After that, I just decided to stop adding people to the wait list. So this term, it should be easier. So I'd say there's at least a 50-50 chance that you're getting in. I'll probably get some drops, and I'll probably go through my wait list for this class. So your chances of adding are maybe a little better, I'll say 50-50. I can't guarantee anything, but if you come back on Wednesday, I might have some good news for you. So I'll just send out a list. For the rest of you, and actually, why don't I do this? I will send around a list, and if you want to add the class, just like circle your name and put "want to add" in big letters. Everybody else, just put down your name on this piece of paper. This is my backup for attendance. I don't take attendance for the first week. The college requires me to eliminate non-participating students. For the purposes of this class, I just use this paper list as a backup. But what I go through for primarily, what I use is logging into the Moodle system. So this is a hybrid class, and there's students listening online. Hello to the online students. But since the section I'm talking to here in the classroom is the hybrid class, you're required to do 1 hour of work outside of class online, 3 hours in class. That's why when you look at the schedule, you thought, 4 credits, but I'm only in class 3 hours a week? All right. Somebody must have made a clerical error in putting together the schedule. No, you're still required to have 4 hours of class contact time, as they say, with the instructor, but 1 hour of that will be in online activities, primarily through participating in an online forum. As part of a hybrid class, I have no reservations of requiring you to log in the Moodle course system by Thursday evening of this week. If you do not log in by Thursday evening, you may be dropped from the course, and one of the numerous students who want to add the course may get your spot. So please remember to do that. Let's say Thursday before 11:55 p.m., and then I'm going to go through my class list, and I have a list of logins. Anybody who hasn't logged in can be booted from the class, and I can make room for other students. And this is also true for you online students. Make sure to log in the first week. I sent out an announcement to everyone this morning. If you haven't enabled your email address in Moodle, you should make sure to do that so you get these announcements, or you should log into the Moodle system every day to check the announcements. But as a backup, I'm going to send this around. Again, if you want to add the class, just put "wants to add" next to your name, circle it, and put a bunch of asterisks so I can see it easily, find it easily. Okay, who here has never used the Moodle course system? Anybody? Okay, a few people. So if you go to lanecc.edu, you don't even need the www, just you go down on this toolbar here, right underneath. Apply now. And see where it says Moodle. You just click on that. Or you can just go to classes.lanecc.edu. Either one works. And then you wait for the server to come up. And you wait. First day, things will be slow. There are occasional outages, although we're migrating to moving, having Moodle hosts here on campus. I'm not sure if they've done all that yet, but that should also improve service having the server here on campus and being able to manage it and so on. Put in your L number, complete with the L. The first 6 digits of your PIN. Get the return key. And then you wait some more. And then some more. Okay, and then you have a list, so you can see I'm taking the poetry class here. The class I'm taking, I'm not teaching it. James Kaiser, who's awesome. If you live in the Grove, or you mind going out there, College Grove classes tend to be under-enrolled. It just takes, 20 minutes on the freeway, maybe less if you drive real fast. And you can take class out in the Grove. This is a one-night-a-week deal, so if you're interested, it's a poetry class. And a lot of this is popular music lyrics, song lyrics, and James is also an expert in H.P. Lovecraft and horror literature, and a fun guy. So here's our class. So all the classes for which you have a Moodle section will be listed there, and click on the class. Once you do that, you've confirmed your enrollment. The way I like to interact with my students, my preferred form of communication is the Moodle message. This is the messages block over here. I look washed out. Can we see that? Somebody like to even turn off the front row lights there. One of you guys in the back there. Figure out which one it is. That's the one. All right. So to communicate with people, you can actually, a cool thing you can do with this, first I could just click any of these things here and have the messages come up. One thing you should remember is that once you click this, the message appears, and then it doesn't appear again unless you click message history or something and remember who the message was from. So I'm not going to click any of these. If you click messages here, this messages block, hangs out here. And then when I send you a message, it will pop up right away, which is kind of handy. You can... One of the things you can do... To see, I have Tanya there as my assistant, and... she's a contact. She's not online now. It shows me that. And so one of the things that's useful to do is to add me as a contact. So you can either search for me by typing in my name here and then add me as a contact. I don't think I can add myself as a contact. But how about my friend Joe Escobar? Escobar. There is Joe. Also, if you could, the first week, add a picture in Moodle. So I can get to know you. It's particularly important for online students. If you don't have a picture, some kind of an icon or something, so I don't see the blank silhouette in Moodle or the happy face or whatever they've got going on, just to add, to help me remember who you are. And so I just click on Joe. I can type in a message and click send message, or I can add contact. And when I click add contact, I don't have to search for his name again. Anyway, the wait time should improve in Moodle after the first day. It's overburdened today just because of the first day of classes. Anyway, it could be the network here too. Sometimes the Moodle course system is just fine, but the network on campus is experiencing problems. Okay. So now, next time I click on messages, there's Joe there. So anytime I want to message him, I can just click it and send him a message, which is kind of handy. Just any place in Moodle, get the announcement section. And wait some more, wait some more. I think the last thing I'm going to demonstrate in Moodle, I'm going to go with yield. Whiteboard in a moment here. But this is my preferred form of communication, email second. Oh, here we go. So you can just, any place you see my name in Moodle, you can just click on it and send me a message that way. And that'll work too. And I have my office hours for this term. That's for last term. Make sure to update the information on your profile. I haven't done that yet. I'm going to do that right after class today. You can fill in your interests and so on. But then just to send a message here, I can check my messages here. I can't send myself a message, I guess. But you can, at the bottom here, you'll get a send message there, so you can do that too. If I were to do that with someone else, I would get that. All right. So this is the way, in Moodle, I almost only get messages from students enrolled in my courses. It helps me prioritize messages. You'll get a reply within 24 hours, excluding holidays and vacation time. Email, it might take me a day or two. Phone messages, it might take me a day or two or three. My absolute least favorite thing to do is to walk into my office and see that hateful orange message light staring me in the face. And when I've gone through every other message I've gotten, an email, phone, I've dealt with students that come into my office, finally I look over that message light, and the message light looks back at me and I think, okay, I guess I better listen to these long, involved emails, and they meander around, and the person goes to get their contact information. I'm ready to type their phone number, and then it's incomprehensible. Their cell phone cuts out, or they say it really fast, and I can't understand them. Or they have some kind of non-standard sounding name, and they don't spell it, and I can't even figure out what they're saying. And so so phone messages get answered last. Make sure to read the syllabus the first week, and actually on my announcements here, the things you should be doing the first week. Log into Moodle, read the syllabus. No paper syllabus in this class. We're saving trees and printing costs for the department. You can read that online. Again, it's a hybrid class. No reason for me to print out my four-page syllabus, which many students don't read anyway, so it's just a waste of paper. I would recommend you read the syllabus, and if you send me a Moodle message or an email with a question which is answered in the syllabus, I will often send a curt reply, have you read the syllabus? Which is the hint that your question has been answered in the syllabus. You should log into Moodle. Again, logging into Moodle means I won't drop you from the class. If you want to drop yourself after that, you can do so by Sunday, 11:59 p.m. To get your money back. You should do it by the end of the 8th week, Friday, 5 p.m., end of the 8th week, to avoid getting a grade. So if you don't drop after Friday, 5 p.m. the 8th week, you will get a grade, and that grade will probably be an F, maybe an NC if I'm feeling charitable. So you should make sure to do that with all your courses. And then next week, make sure that you haven't been dropped from any of your courses and don't know about it. Okay, so log into Moodle, enable your email address and your profile, introduce yourself. I'll get the personal introductions form up right after class. Read syllabus, get the text from the LCC bookstore, read chapter 1 and 2. That's what we will be covering this week. We're going to be covering chapter 1 today, and you can read it for next class. Chapter 2 is a little more involved, a little longer, but the chapter 1 is very, very short, and so we'll be covering both chapter 1 and 2 today and tomorrow. Let me just actually look at the weekly form. But I decided that was too much for the first week. If you're ever wondering what we're doing, actually, we may get a little into chapter 2 on Wednesday, but it looks like I have. I decided that I was too much to cram into week 1. So chapter 2 is slated for week 2. So you should always do the reading before class. And so chapter 2, Rationalism, we will start next Monday. Here's the weekly outline. So if you're ever wondering what we're doing, here's our schedule. We're taking approximately one chapter a week. Although you can see in a couple of weeks, we break up the chapters, the larger chapters, into two weeks. So we cover chapter 3 over 2 weeks, and I think chapter 7 goes over 2 weeks. I think the stuff on Barclay. Chapter 3 actually is a very long one, so we think we take 3 weeks for that. Anyway, it's all there. And that's all I'm going to say about the syllabus. Make sure to read it in its entirety. Actually, I will say one other thing, which is about course requirements. And so, syllabus didn't pop up. There we go. So, you have 3 exams and an online form. The 3 exams make up each 30% of your grade, including the final. the online forum is 10% of your grade. The exams have to be taken in the testing lab. You'll have about a week to do them, 4 days for the final, multiple choice, true, false, and you can take it anytime the testing lab's open. This is part of your outside of class work that you're required to do. New class material will be presented as the test is ongoing, and so we won't be taking class time out for you to fill out little scantrons or anything. That will be outside of class. The test will be based on the reading and our in-class discussions. I do some lecture material that's not in the text. There's some material in the text which I don't cover in class, so you need to look at both and attend class and so on and so forth. Any questions about the course requirements? Anything else? Okay, just make sure to read the syllabus for next time and also chapter one. And I think let's launch into some discussion about the material. That's pretty good, only 17 minutes of walking and taking care of administrivia. Okay. Can you turn the lights on in the back, please? Hopefully I'm coming through. It's kind of weak looking. Although, pulling up that screen did a good job there. Okay, again, if you want to speak, make sure to project, from the diaphragm, as they say. And also, if my volume drops and you can't hear me, feel free to interrupt me and say, "I can't hear," or louder or something, because sometimes I'll trail off if I'm in the middle of a thought, and particularly as class wears on and I don't become mindful of hitting the back of the room. So, start off with a philosophical question. What is truth? There's a scene from one of the Gospels where Jesus is before Pontius Pilate, and Jesus makes some comment about, "I'm the way, the truth, and life," or whatever. He makes some comment about the truth, and Pontius Pilate says, "What is the truth?" And it's kind of a skeptical, cynical comment, I think, and Pilate's idea is that, as it says in Jesus Christ Superstar, Pilate says, "What is truth is mine the same as yours?" And it's a kind of a skeptical or relativist view of the truth. But when you think about the word truth and the way it's used, and not necessarily just truth with a capital T, but when you say something like X is truth, what does that mean when you say something is true? What does this mean? And then another question, when you say X is true, what does this mean? You could also ask the question, what sorts of things, are true? When you say, X is true, What kind of things are X? Can anything be true? Truth seems to be some kind of a quality. Or is truth like a thing? Thoughts?
I always thought of truth as just a statement that has facts and evidence to back it up.
The facts. Now, you said something about evidence to back it up. Let me ask this. Can you have evidence for a statement that's false? Or can you have evidence for something that's false?
Yes, can.
Yeah, so it's kind of tough. It seems that evidence, if you have evidence that something is true, that makes you think that it helps you make a judgment about whether it's true or not. But the evidence and the truth are different things. You use the evidence to prove something is true. So I'm gonna say, let's Well, this seems like it belongs someplace else. But it's definitely related to truth.
Could math be something that's true? Like when you say X is true, I mean...
Sure, what kinds of things are true? Math, mathematics, how about... Then what is, I suppose you ask the question, what is mathematics? What sorts of things are true? Math? How about mathematics, and particularly, what is mathematics made of?
Formulas?
Mm-hmm. You know, the formulas. Well, how about the simulants? Formulas? I like formulas of math. Sometimes people use the word axioms. The symbols, they ask this question. That's true or false? The number two.
It's true.
It's true?
It depends on the context.
I would say it seems kind of funny to say that the number two is true or false. Although the number two can be in something else that could be true or false. And the question is, what is the something else? I think some of these, I like formulas, axioms. What else can, besides math, what else can be true?
Just something you can perceive. You can see it, touch it, feel it. It must be true.
Okay. Oh, blue.
Your
blue
belief,
true or false? Because I can
beliefs.
See blue, right? What's that?
I was saying your beliefs or your own reality is true to yourself, right? It may not be true for somebody else, but it's your reality.
Okay, now we're getting some interesting comments here. So, beliefs, so like that. What does this mean?
Well, your reality is made up of your beliefs and your experiences that are true just to your own self.
So all my beliefs are true for me?
I would believe so.
So can I ever make a mistake?
Yeah.
Well, then it seems like if you ever believe something turned out it was false. Like, I remember when I was a kid, I believed in Santa Claus. My nephew, who's 9 years old, going on 6, still believes in Santa Claus. He has a false belief. And at some point, hopefully, he's going to realize that belief's false. Because evidence, right? He starts thinking, wait, he's actually learning about science. And he starts thinking about the logistics of, like, you know, one guy going around the whole world and giving presents to all the children. Or maybe he sees, dad or mom sneaking downstairs in the middle of the night and, you know, putting the cookie crumbs on the plate and the glass of milk, you know, and doing all that. And putting down presents that say from Santa, and he figures it out. Or maybe one of his playmates tells him, right? Yeah.
Truth is not relative. It have to be absolute.
Yeah. And this is actually one of the big disputes about truth, whether truth is relative or not. When you say something's true, sometimes people, when they say it's true for me, it seems that all they really mean is they believe it. But it seems that even when you believe something, there's a question about whether it's true or not still, right? You can have a belief, and the belief could be true or it could be false, right? Unless you think you can never have a false belief. That's kind of a tough thing. And it seems like everyone's thought, it came up with a situation where they had something they believed, which they rejected later as being false, and they say, oh yeah, I believe something which is false, and I believe something else which is true. And the reason they accepted the new belief and jettisoned the false, or the old belief, is because they thought the old one was true, the old one was false, and the new one was true. And it's pretty unusual to have someone reject a belief because it's true, and or accept it because it's false. Thoughts? Yes?
Yeah, I was wondering, what about when then a belief is so widely accepted that it becomes true? Like, say for instance, the categories of race. Like, we don't necessarily have genetic divisions that create these racial boundaries, but through belief, extended belief in such a large community, we've come across this section of the population that believes that that is true.
Now, when you say something becomes true because it's widely believed, how does that happen? How do you go from lots of people believe X to X is true?
That's a that's what the definition, you know, a common belief and a common truth could be different just how it's said, but in the context of the sentence.
Well, let me ask a related question. Are there any widely beliefs which were once widely accepted which turn out to be false?
The
world is flat. The world is the center of the universe. Right. Two good examples. Right. People at one time, most people believed the Earth was the center of the universe, or that the Earth was flat, and it turned out not to be the case. What? Why not?
Science.
Science, and like more particularly what?
We'll come back to this evidence there. We keep coming back to
that people received evidence, and the evidence came in kind of slowly. So actually, the Greeks figured this out back in, you know, I think 212 BC. There's a guy who knows the science, right? So, and they even calculated, you know, the circumference of the Earth and all kinds of stuff. But they figured out that the Earth was spinning like a top on its axis and revolving around the. Revolving around the sun, as opposed to the idea of the Earth stationary and the sun's revolving around it. And it, you know, some of the evidence had to do with we got really good telescopes, and you look at like the planet Mars and like Venus, and you track it across the sky, and you expect it to just sort of go around in a circle, but it would do this thing. And when you're looking at a crappy telescope or just with the naked eye and tracking it, it looks like that because you can't see the detail. But you see this what's called retrograde motion of planets, which makes a lot of sense if it does this. Why? Because you're on the Earth, which is spinning around like this, and so you get that effect. And people put it together and said, okay, here's the proof. But that's evidence for what? Is it evidence for what people believe, or is it evidence for something else? Does the telescope tell you what you believe when you look in the telescope? Does it show you your beliefs?
The telescope's not like a magic 8-ball that will just validate whatever you're saying. It points you in the right direction, but it doesn't specifically answer the question. You need to look at all the evidence and validate it for yourself.
Can I say that a little louder, please? That's good stuff.
With a telescope, it doesn't just answer the question for you. You have to observe all the different evidence that's available, and then based on the evidence that's available, then you come up with your conclusions.
Yeah, so when you're thinking about, when you're looking at your beliefs, you just close your eyes, like, what do I believe now? And, you know, you can see what you believe. But when you're trying to figure out what's true, it seems that you use evidence and you maybe use some reasoning and some of your previous beliefs, but you want to look out there in the world. And sometimes it turns out the evidence from your senses, for example, might invalidate one of your beliefs. And so the telescope showed you not what you believed, it showed you the way the world is. And this isn't necessarily to say that the senses are the only way to know something's true. Like, for example, if I said I have a circular square in my pocket, and suppose I bet you $50 that I do, who here would take up that bet with me? Nobody. A circular square? It's exactly circular and exactly square. And it's also triangular. I'll throw in that just to make the bet interesting. It's a circular triangular square, which is a perfect sphere, and has 12 corners and 7 sides. It's a 7-sided triangular spherical square. You know that just your mind tells you those are incompatible concepts, and you think there's no way I could possibly have an object like that in my pocket because those are incompatible concepts. It doesn't have to do with your senses. It has to do with your mind, with your reason, with concepts. So that's another way of knowing things, is by concepts. Comes back to math, right? I would say 2 and 2 is 4 is not an empirical truth. Some people object. Some people think the way you know 2 and 2 is 4 is you take, you know, okay, I got 2 objects here, and I take 2 objects here. oh, turns out 2 and 2 is 4. I proved it. But I'd say that if you understand the concept of 2, and you understand the concept of 4, the concept of addition, the concept of equality, you can know that that's true, and you're not going to be doing experiments to try to validate that. Now, maybe when you're a kid and you're first learning this stuff, you need to learn through rote memorization. But you can comprehend the rules of mathematics without doing any empirical experiments. And look, no, could you imagine an experiment which would turn out to invalidate that? But suppose I said, you know, the other day I put together 2 objects and 2 objects, and suddenly there was 5. So I think I have proof that 2 and 2 is 5. Come to my office and I'll show you. We'll try to reproduce the experiment. What do you think? You think, well, you're nuts, right? Because there's no possible way that you could prove just by counting objects that 2 and 2 was 5. It's a conceptual trick. But it's still based on the way the world is. Mathematics is part of the way the world is. It's not about the way your beliefs are. And it seems that what the rational person should do is they should proportion their beliefs to the way the world is, as opposed to trying to make the world fit their beliefs, which is what people do a lot of the time. Thoughts, disputations, counterarguments. Yes, sir, Tony.
What if you have a belief that you can't prove but can't be disproved? Then is it still your reality? It might not be somebody else's.
Wouldn't that follow like under religion? A lot of religions like that, isn't it?
Not necessarily. I think religion can be confirmed or disconfirmed. I'll go out on a limb and I think that religious propositions may be proved or disproved, although not all religious propositions. But just take anything that you might not know. What about, how about this?
There are 9 planets in the solar system. I know. I'm not saying this proposition is true. This is actually kind of this might be from a company.
So how would you know whether that's true or false? Yeah.
First, you need to define, you know, what a planet is, what you're looking for, right?
Yeah. So let's take an easier one. The Earth is the 3rd planet from the Sun. In 2 million BC.
Right, so if you think about 2 million BC, you got some sort of proto-hominids walking around. They don't know anything about astronomy. They don't even have a sense that stars, that some of the lights up in the sky are planets and other lights are distant suns. So they don't know, or just you know, take 10,000 BC or something, before people understood what planets were. But it was still true, right? It was still, the Earth was still the 3rd planet out from the Sun because of the way the world was. Even before there were people, say, before there were human beings, that would still be true. Even if no one was there to know it. So I'd say some things it's really hard to tell. Julius Caesar had a big breakfast before he crossed the Rubicon in 43 BC. Let's take that statement. Can we ever know that it's true? But it seems like it still has a truth value. Something happened that morning. Either Caesar had a breakfast or he didn't have a breakfast. Either he ate a lot or he didn't eat a lot. We might never know what it is, what the truth of that is, but it still has a truth value. It's just undetermined or unknown. So I'd say that just because you can't know something, don't know something, or even have no means of figuring it out, doesn't mean that it's not true or false. It just means that you can't tell. So you should withhold judgment on that. Say, well, we don't know. I don't know what Caesar had for breakfast or whether he even had breakfast before he crossed the Rubicon in 43 BC. That he crossed the Rubicon in 43 BC, I think there's good evidence for. I get the date right. It's 43 BC. Take Columbus Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492? Or was it in 1493 Columbus sailed the deep blue sea? No, I think it's 92. So that's a statement. But you know, he had a fondness for limes. You know, I don't know whether he liked not limes or not. There might not be anything in his journals about whether he liked limes. And so it, you know, that might be undetermined. Doesn't mean it doesn't have a truth value, because either he liked limes or he didn't. Right? There's some truth to the matter. So coming back to this, what kinds of things are true? What does this and this and this, what kinds of things are these? Yeah.
What about going back to the math thing?
Okay.
Didn't what's his name, Gödel, say that nothing's, there is no self-consistent set of axioms or anything?
That's true.
So there was really no like true foundation that we could put anything on.
That doesn't follow necessarily.
Does not follow.
Just because there's, and then we're getting into some abstruse stuff about meta logic. I'd say that. Okay, just let me. This would be a good answer. When you ask the question, didn't Gödel say X? Does that statement have a truth value? Seems that it does, right? Because either he did or he didn't. And if you pull out like a book, and by this guy, he's a German mathematician, philosopher, logician, and you show me here's where he says that, then it's true. I have good evidence that it's true. If not, then they're not, or maybe it's undetermined. So what he's talking about is there's sort of an argument about what logic is and how it's related to mathematics, and it gets kind of complicated. But I'd say it doesn't invalidate the ordinary theories of truth. So let me just start out with this, that the sorts of things that are true, what sorts of things are true? Philosophers like talking about beliefs, which we already have up here, statements, and propositions. We're especially fond about talking about propositions. Although some of the linguistic philosophers like statements. A belief is, all these are related to propositions. The proposition is the thing which is true or false. Now, a proposition can be a mental representation, in which case it's a belief. It can be a statement, whether written or uttered, spoken, in which case that's a representation. It can be written or uttered. So it's a difference between what's something that's mental and something that's expressed in language. You can just talk about the abstract thing, which is true or false. Sometimes philosophers get really fancy and they talk about sentences. A sentence refers to a statement in a particular language. So if I say, mais je ne suis pas comme ça, that means, but I'm not like that. And so those are two statements, you know, one in French and one in English, which have equivalent meaning and equivalent truth value. One's in one language and one's in another. So you can get kind of fancy there and talk about statements in a particular language. You're talking about a sentence. But all of these are things which are true or false, and they're going to be the same, right? If I say the cat is on the mat, that's a statement. If I write the sentence, the cat is on the mat in English, it's going to be the same as if I, and that's going to be a statement that's going to be, to have the same content as my belief the cat is on the mat. So when you're talking about the thing which is true or false, it's the cat is on the mat. And it can be represented in different ways. But that's the proposition, the cat is on the mat, can have a lot of different expressions or representations. And then what does it mean to say the cat is on the mat? Under what conditions is the statement the cat is on the mat true?
Only if the cat is on the mat.
There you go. If and only if the cat is on the mat, then the statement the cat is on the mat is true. What if I believe the cat is on the mat?
You can believe all you want. It's true.
Yeah, there you go. So, you know, I can believe I can fly, right? And I can climb up to a tall building and jump off. And if I, it doesn't matter how strongly I believe it, I'm going to plummet like a rock and die unless there's a garbage strike or something and I land on a bunch of trash that's out in the street. As happened the last couple days. Thoughts? Counter-arguments?
So there's lots of people living in untrue realities then.
Well, what do you mean by how about reality?
Well, because like when you're saying if you're in, when you're in your reality and you have a belief that's not true by the rest of the world, but you still believe in it, that does that mean you're living in a false reality?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the word reality. If by reality you just mean everything you believe, then I guess you could use that word that way. That's not what I mean by reality.
Your concept of the world.
Well, you're talking about belief now, though, right?
Yeah.
Isn't there a difference between belief and reality?
Well,
reality and illusion?
I could believe that the world is just this peachy clean world, and if we talk nice to each other and get along and everything will be fine, and that's not the reality.
And through your beliefs, you create your reality.
How does that work? Exactly.
Like whatever you believe,
That's
your reality. That's your personal reality.
So if I believe
how things you, the law of attraction.
But in that is something.
Hey, I want to stick with what she's got here. Do you want to comment on what she was saying? Okay, good. Go ahead. Speak loudly, please.
Yeah. With that, what if something outside that you don't perceive as reality for you affects you, and there's nothing you can do? I mean, it's there. You didn't think it was real, but now it's. You have to.
When your reality adjusts. Yeah.
So the world adjusts to your belief, not the other way around? Like, so...
Yeah. I think the law of attraction is pretty big.
I've heard about this law of attraction. So the idea, if you believe something strong enough, it will occur?
That's so true. Like your will to... You can will things in this world.
Yeah. What about like all the people that get like cancer or they get old or you know I would love to be 50 pounds lighter and to have $1 million and I can sort of go down the line of all the things that I desire.
I mean, fine line there. Like you still, you know, things are going to happen to you for a reason, and I think a lot of people who think negatively a lot sometimes their body, you know.
But
that's like a causal interaction. I can understand, like, if I'm really depressed, then I'm going to have all these hormones and stuff in my body, which make me, you know, send my body all sorts of negative symbols, signals. If I'm stressed, you know, and I'm all, you know, my blood pressure's up, I might have a heart attack, right? That's, my mind affects my body. Right, I watch Wrath of Khan, Star Trek 2, and I see the ending scene where Spock dies and Captain Kirk's moving funeral oration. A little tear wells up, right? That's a physiological effect. But if I'm thinking, I believe I have $1 million, is a sack full of money going to drop down on my lap?
There's stories of people writing themselves $1 million check and just every day visualizing that, willing it. Jim Carrey is one of the people who did it.
Yep, it worked. Really,
it seems like Jim Carrey got his money from acting, not from like trying to believe stuff really strongly.
Well, he was a struggling comedian and they put him off stage his first time he went on, you know, but he believed in himself and wrote that check, and later on, of course, he's getting $20 million.
It's
self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is.
It's not something based in reality. It's just something that you make yourself do.
Well, I mean,
you motivate yourself by doing so.
Maybe we're getting a little bit.
What do we know? What the bleep do we know?
I have.
Now, that is, there's a thing in there that is relevant to what we're talking about, where they do the study with water, and they have negative comments to it, and it corrodes, and it turns black, and then they talk positive to it, and it, like, crystallizes and become beautiful. And they correlate that to us, how we're 90% water, and what negative self-talk can do to yourself, as opposed to positive,
I would challenge anyone to demonstrate that occurring in this room, and I don't think they would be able to do it.
Me too.
There's no empirical evidence that's true. Water is H2O. It has certain properties which are known by science. And I would like some evidence that was true. Maybe I'd change my belief.
I saw a book that says, like, this is what we did to this water, and it's like a close-up, microscopic close-up of the water, and the crystals change.
But I've read all kinds of things in books. I read, stories about towers reaching to heaven and talking snakes and people being abducted by aliens and, all kinds of stuff. You think everything you read in a book is true?
No, not necessarily, but...
It was pretty compelling. It was touching to see it,
There's this book, The Secret Life of Plants, which talks about, like, this guy's got a cabbage out there. And he's got like a big cleaver, like a chopper, and he chops the cabbage, and then he brings in like the cabbage buddy, and holds up the cleaver and hooks up an electroencephalogram to the other cabbage, and the cabbage is scared because the needle's going over the place. And just crazy stuff. Now it could be the needle's moving, but not because the cabbage is scared. But we were getting a little field. Let me just say this, that it seems that you're arguing on the basis of evidence. I don't think very good evidence, but at least you're presenting evidence that a proposition is true, right? You're trying to convince me that your beliefs can affect the external world. But that itself is a statement which you're claiming is true. And you're claiming the world works this way, that if you have a belief, it will affect, change the world and make it different. Well, that seems to go against this idea that whatever you believe is true, because it seems that you believe that my view of the world is false, because I think that your belief can affect the world in this way. If I believe in myself, I may do things and have certain attitudes and beliefs which lead me to do things, my physical body interacting in the way I walk and talk and type stuff on the internet and what have you, which lead to the effects that I desire. But my belief itself doesn't have any causal effect in the world. That's my view. Well, either one of those beliefs is true, right? They can't both be true. And they're not true based on what's in my mind or what's in your mind. It's based on the way the world is. So either it's the case that my belief directly affects the rest of the world through some kind of metaphysical, cosmic energy or something, or it's just that I have certain attitudes, they affect my physiology, they affect the way I interact with other people in the physical world, and I indirectly can change reality in that way. But what seems, could you imagine, could both those beliefs be true? It seems like only one of those, go ahead.
Can they be true for you as an individual?
Now, what do you mean by true for you? Maybe come back to the true for you. Is truth the way the world is, or is truth what you believe?
I keep wanting to say the same thing, though. Can it just be true for you? But then I'm kind of, as we talk more, I'm seeing that you're getting to a bigger picture of the.
Does true for you mean anything different than what you believe? That's a good question, right? So there's what you believe, what's in your mind, what you think is true, and then there's what is actually true. Are you seeing those?
Like,
the
I
same
have my
thing?
Truth, and you have your truth.
But then truth has lost its value.
Well, what is that? When you say I have my truth, what does that mean? Does that mean I have my beliefs and you have your beliefs?
Yeah, because there's so many different belief systems now. We're all programmed to coexist together and have acceptance of that, So
right.
We instantly just say, I'm different than you. You have yours, but I'm accepting of it.
And that's true for you, and this is true for me. I think if someone can logically disagree with it, then it's not necessarily true. Like, you can't disagree that the cat on the mat is the cat in the mat.
Well, what if the person's hallucinating?
Good question. Yeah. So far we've got, suppose we have the following. I believe X, you believe Y. X and Y are logically incompatible propositions. And just take, we could take anything. We could take everything from the metaphysical belief that your belief affects reality in certain ways, or we could take it as, think of something very extremely mundane. Whether President Spilby is Canadian or Scottish, right? So it could be something that's completely mundane, or it could be something kind of cosmic or philosophical. But so we have two, and suppose the proposition would be, say, you know, President Spilsby is mostly Scottish and is not Canadian at all, or she's mostly Canadian, not Scottish at all, what have you. So we define our propositions, and we decide they're mutually exclusive. Then it seems that you can ask the question, is X or Y the truth or true? Or, you know, or maybe it's some other proposition Z. It might be some other third thing. Maybe she's neither Scottish nor Canadian. Maybe it turns out she's German, right? But it seems that there's some truth in the matter. What does it mean to say that the proposition President Spilsby is Scottish is true? What does that mean? Does it have to do with people's beliefs?
So you're saying truth is independent from belief?
Yeah, I would say that.
And you would also be saying that truth would be absolute, right?
Truth?
I mean, truth is, doesn't change regardless of somebody's conception of reality or somebody's beliefs or somebody's blah, blah, blah. It's all based on what is.
That's a great definition of truth. Truth is what is. Falsity is that which is not. Actually, Aristotle says this in one of the first books written on logic. And he says, he makes the controversial statement, what is, is. What is not, is not. That would seem like common sense, right? So you can describe what is true. What do we mean when something's true? You mean it's that which is, that which exists, that which obtains, the state of affairs of the world. A true statement describes the world the way it is. A false statement describes the world other than it is. If I say Portland is the capital of Oregon, that is a false statement. Why? Because that's not the way the world is. Capital is Salem, right? If I say New York City is the capital of New York, that's a false statement. It's Albany. If I say Albany is New York, that's kind of a tricky one, right? Because, there's an Albany, New York, and then there's an Albany, Oregon. So then what does that mean? The truth is relative, that we can't know anything? No, it just means that you have to define your terms. And I could say, well, you know, that's an ambiguous symbol there, or an ambiguous referent. When you say Albany, are you speaking of the Albany in the state of New York? Because there's an Albany in Oregon as well. It would be pretty silly if Albany, Oregon was the capital of New York. But I suppose it's a possibility. Broadly, logically speaking. So, truth is, a true statement is one which describes the world the way it is. The cat is in the mat is true if the cat really is in the mat. The truth is what is, a false statement is that which is not. Now, let's come back to this, your own reality, true for you. Yeah.
Doesn't relativity come into play, though? I mean, like with the case of blue.
Uh-huh.
What, you know, like you have colorblind people that, don't...
Blue is a measure of a wavelength. I mean, it's something you can measure.
Right.
Like, I forget the number, but it's a measurable wavelength. It's not just the color that you perceive.
It has to do with perception, right? Because what you see is...
Well, no, it's independent of perception. I mean, perception is relative because it's based on experience.
Right, it can be measured, but...
It might be that
the wavelength itself is absolute. It doesn't change just because you believe it changes or because you believe it's a different length. It's independent.
Wonder blind, though, that
it's... Well, that doesn't negate it. That just doesn't mean you can't see it.
Well, describe blue to a blind person.
I couldn't. I could describe it to somebody who understands lengths. I can describe it to somebody who understands colors. I could, but it's independent of my perception.
You don't have to understand lengths to understand what color is, though.
Yeah, I think that the problem is there's an ambiguity in the term blue. So what I would say is define your terms. Blue seems like it's ambiguous between it's a wavelength of light, which is, you know, so many nanometers, and we describe like the space between the troughs and the peaks. And one of you sciencey guys know what the wavelength of light is. And when I was in school, it was all angstroms. Now it's all nanometers. I know that halogen lights are more blue than tungsten lights. That's why they have that annoying blue glow when you're looking in the rearview mirror and being blinded. And I know that if you set your camera the wrong way, you don't put it on tungsten for an indoor thing, and you have an older camera, you're going to get like these really orangey or really blue-looking photographs, which look all screwy. It has to do with the wavelength of the light. So, but there's also, blue can also mean a sensation, which is like what you're hitting at. And those two things we think go together. But not always, because why do you see things as blue? We'll actually get into this when we talk about Locke. Locke talks a lot about color and how we see colors. Why do you see some objects as blue?
Because they absorb the wavelength of the light and make it blue.
Yeah, so an object appears as blue to us because it absorbs every other wavelength but a certain kind, which it reflects into our eyes. Those light waves bounce off of the object into our eyes, and we actually have color receptors there. And those color receptors will create a blue sensation in our minds based on what's happening with the, you know, it converts the wavelength to impulses that go down our optic nerve and go into our brain. Our brain does a little dance with all the electrons moving around there, jumping across the neurons, and we get a blue sensation. So that's why we see things as blue. Now, some people, they have different non-standard color receptors. They don't have any color receptors. The color receptors are damaged or deformed in some way, so they see colors differently than us. And maybe, you know, an alien from the planet Zontar doesn't see colors at all because he has no color receptors. Does that mean the truth is relative? No, I just described, like, you know, all the different propositions which describe how we see color. And it's just, and I've explained why some people don't see blue, or you might say why some people are blind. And it seems that those are perfectly understandable, everyday statements people make to try to explain why people have different perceptions and how reality is different from perception. Now, if you're like, if you're a small child, right, you have a problem distinguishing fantasy from reality, between what appears to you and what's the case. So you might like try to hide someone by like putting your hands over your face, right? You think, oh, when I put my hands over the face, the world disappears. And if I can't see my dad can't see me, right? You go like this, like, and you're hiding from your dad. And some animals are like this too. They'll like stick their head in a box and think that they're hidden from view. But once you get some, you know, sophistication, sophisticated nervous system, sophisticated mind, you realize, oh, there's a difference between what appears to me and what may be the case. And that's how learning happens, right? How, let me ask this question. How would you ever learn anything if you never made a mistake or never believed you had any, ever thought any of your beliefs were false? Some of my most instructive learning experiences are when a gang of facts have assaulted one of my pet theories. And it turns out, oh, I guess that isn't true. Or sometimes it's humiliating and embarrassing. When you realize you have a false belief. But, you know, that's what you want to do, it seems, is the world is one way, right? The world, what is, and what is one determinate thing. Although people have different perceptions of it and different conceptions of it. What you want to do is proportion your conceptions and your perceptions as much as you can, I suppose. Yes, but your beliefs about the world, whether they come from the senses or from logic or reason or, you know, what you read in a book or just your whole worldview, you want that to match up with the real world as much as possible. And that's one of the goals of this class. And then, what, you ever know anybody that to say, well, what I want to do is the reverse. I want the world to match my preconceptions of it. What words do we have to describe that?
Crazy.
I suppose crazy, right, is one. Rationalization. Like, I was talking to one guy, and he said, well, you know, the Jews control the world, and they control the media. And I said, well, about Rupert Murdoch, he's not a Jew. And they said, yeah, well, they got to have a couple of Gentile puppets there so we can get wise to their schemes. And so, like, whatever new piece of evidence you show, you know, here's, you know, all the Jews control all the media. Rupert Murdoch, you know, runs News Corp and Fox News and Washington Times and a whole bunch of other, you know, media. He's a big media mogul, right? And they say, well, you know, he's just a Gentile puppet. meaning a non-Jew in league with the Zionist conspiracy.
A person that is firmly locked in a particular ideology is going to ignore all facts and evidence that contradict that.
Until it hits
them
in the face.
Yeah, sometimes, and sometimes it never does, I guess, but yeah. So that's...
If somebody believes that inhaling water won't make you drown, they're gonna, just because...
What if it's happy water?
I'm gonna do it
if I'm not drowning. Yeah, it depends on how much it is, right? You can actually die from drinking too much water, and so... Some people found out the hard way at a radio contest.
Yeah, down in Sacramento, yeah. For that gaming system, that's terrible.
And so, the thing is, I would say that if you strongly believe that you can drink as much water as you like and you won't have any bad health effects, you'd be in for a rude surprise at a certain point. It might be different from person to person. So, I don't know, other thoughts about truth and reality? I want to make sure we can... plumb the depths of this. Yes, and speak loudly, please. You're kind of in the back.
Go back to the concept of a whole group of people believing something and that making it true for themselves. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying then is that it doesn't make it true necessarily. The more true statement would be that this large group of people holds this false belief,
mm-hmm.
and that influences their reality, their world, and it changes things for them, yes, and the reality is dependent upon this false belief, but it is still a false belief. It does not become true in any way just because lots of people believe.
Well, yeah, I like that last statement. A few of those things, like you talk about it determines their reality. It seems like it's using reality in kind of a funny way. Because you could, it seems like what I'll turn around and say is, well, when you say reality, do you mean reality or do you mean reality? Right?
The social construct that each individual creates for themselves, our perception, I guess, is
yeah.
what I'm getting.
So you're coming. So I'd say that's something different than reality, which is what is. And so to avoid talking past one another, I choose use the word reality to represent reality. And then if you're going to talk about perception or belief or social constructs, I call those things. Like race is a great example. Race does not exist. Race is a social construct. There is no evidence there's no determinative evidence that people, the amount of melanin in your skin or what shape your nose is or what texture your hair has any effect on personality, on behavior, or what kind of person you are, or your innate intelligence or abilities, and so on and so forth. And this idea that people fall into natural kinds, that you've got the black man, the yellow man, or woman, the black, yellow, red, and the white and whitey, right? You have these four categories, and everybody falls into them, or maybe there's a fifth of you, the Australians got their own category, the Australian Aborigines, or the Australoids, the Negroids, the Caucasoids, and the Mongoloids. And which one am I missing? American Indians are Mongoloid. So I remember when I was in school, they're like, yeah, here are the four or five, they had five classifications of people, and everybody falls in this category. Well, it's all a bunch of crap. There is no race is a social construct, and the idea that people fall into neat little groups. And that surface characteristics like what color your skin is, or what shape your nose is, or whether your hair is straight or curly, that affects your personality, that's a bunch of bunk. But because these are things that people notice most often, and they're surface characteristics, so they're easy to see, people think, oh, that's the type of person you are. And then culture, it gets mixed in with this, and geographic areas, and so on. So, but race is a social construct. It's an illusion. There is no such thing as race. Now, people often behave as if there is, right? Like the racist thinks that race is real, obviously. But that doesn't mean that it is. He has an illusion. I think that the world, this is a good example of how once people realize that race is a social construct and it's not real, you get rid of racism, right? Once people realize it's a bunch of bunk, people think, well, the idea that one race is superior to another is incompatible with the idea there's no such thing as race. So I think that's one instance where it's better if everyone believes what's true. But there's a difference between a social construct and the way the world is. Just take another example. My anthropologist colleagues probably wouldn't like this, but you take, like, say you're in the 1930s in Brazil, and you're some Aboriginal tribe in the deepest, darkest Amazon. And there's a person in your tribe who suddenly falls to the ground and shakes uncontrollably, and their eyes roll up in their head, and they twitch, and they spasm, and they do this like every once in a while. And what do you do? Well, you call the witch doctor, right? The witch doctor puts on a scary ooga booga mask, and he's got like maybe a rattle to make a loud racket, and he tries to command the evil spirits to come out with magical incantations or threats that he's going to sick the good spirits on them. Maybe he's got some potions, that he feeds the victim. And maybe the victim gets a little better and doesn't have the seizures quite as often. And whenever the seizures come back, the witch doctor puts on a scary mask and commands the spirits to leave, and you get some effects. Well, I would say that the medical theory of the witch doctor is mistaken. And modern science can explain what exactly is going on there, that you get the placebo effect, the person expects to get better, maybe there's some effect on the nervous system, they believe the witch doctor is going to cure them, they get some effect. But if you took that person and gave them certain kinds of pharmaceutical drugs, or you maybe, in extreme case, performed an operation on their brain, that you would get better effects. And because that we have an understanding of what causes epilepsy, right? The modern neuroscientist or the modern medical doctor would say, well, this person has epilepsy. You can use these drugs, which have been shown in double-blind controlled experiments to help person with epilepsy, and we might even do some sort of minor operation to cure it. And the results would show, and that the person, if you took that person and treated them with modern scientific methods, that person would do better than with the witch doctor. Now, does it mean that the witch doctor's stupid? Well, no. Does it mean we blame the witch doctor for not believing in science he had no access to as an isolated tribe? No. Should he feel guilty about having a false belief? No. But should we say that his belief is true even when it's not? Because we think we need to be sensitive to other cultures? I would say no.
There's a trade-off there, too, with, like, lifestyles. Like, because we do have modern medicine, a lot of, we're kind of putting this world through a lot of stress because of all the modern stuff we have and what we're doing, and they're living very simply and purely. So there's kind of a...
I'm not sure I'd say purely, but simply, sure. Like, for example, the diet of the Aborigine. Probably a pretty good diet, right? Lots of berries, some roots, not a lot of refined sugars and carbohydrates. Heart disease, I would expect, would be really low. Maybe they eat, and probably not a lot of meat because hunting is tough. So you have a hunter-gatherer society. They're eating some nuts, maybe. Lots of fresh living things out of the ground. They're not going to be dying of heart disease, not developing type 2 diabetes before they hit 40 and so on. Now, those are great. But, you might die of malaria when you're 5 or 30. Or you could die of tuberculosis. Or you'd be eaten by a wild animal or what have you. Much more. And you actually look at Aboriginal cultures, maximum lifespan tends to be a little longer than in modern societies. But overall lifespan tends to be short.
They're not polluting, though, at all. They're not adding any pollutants. Is that what you meant by pure?
Kind of what I was
that's what I was picking up
like
on.
They're living the way that I feel like we're kind of meant to live.
So here's a question. Why have you moved to the jungle of Brazil to live as a...
Well, it's like unrealistic, but...
Well, it's not realistic. You could, like, join the Peace Corps and make friends with the natives, learn their language, and then, like, disappear into one of those isolated tribes.
Sure.
Try to find one that wasn't contaminated by, science or Western culture or whatever you're trying to get away from. And
I
live close to the earth.
For it.
What's that?
I just have a lot of respect for it.
But it wouldn't necessarily be for you?
Not right now.
Not right now. You have to give up things like, hot showers and air conditioning.
Mosquitoes the size of cats.
Yeah. It sounds romantic, but a lot of times people get down there and you're thinking, oh God, it's 90 degree humidity and or 90% humidity and it's 100 degrees and
crawling bugs.
Yeah. But people get used to it, but people get used to anything. So the question is, what's, I suppose, pleasant and what helps you be productive or lead a meaningful life? But way in the back there, and speak loudly, please.
Yeah. The way we're meant to live, if we're able to evolve to be like we are now, then are we meant to live like we are now, or how we could live?
No.
So I don't think that saying that's the way we're meant to live, just because it's kind of how we came from in primal times.
I know, I was just saying the destruction and all that stuff we're doing just to have all these nice things in Western medicine.
Yeah, coming back to the beliefs. So I'd say the witch doctor has a bad theory of disease. He thinks disease is caused by evil spirits. That's a false theory, a bad theory, with a lot of false propositions. On the other end, I'd say that the modern scientific view, the germ disease, the germ theory of disease. And there's also a lot of stuff added on to that, the understanding the immune system and so on and so forth, and understanding nutrition. But the thing is that the scientific view can say, well, look, if you eat all these berries and this fresh fruit, here's all the reasons why this is benefiting you. And here's why the Aboriginal is living longer than some guy selling insurance in New York City. Right? It's because of pollution, it's because of his high-stress lifestyle, his poor diet, his eating large quantities of meat and no fruits and vegetables, no fiber. And we can even identify what the helpful substances are in some of these plant materials, like blueberries or what have you, that are really good for you. Whereas the Aboriginal just sort of goes on what best guesses over a long period of time about what sorts of things are helpful. But you might get somebody who's got comes down with malaria, and they decide, well, we're going to get all the evil spirits out by bleeding you, right? And that might not be the best treatment. So the advantage of the scientific worldview in that you can understand all the things that helps the Aboriginal live as well as he does, and also have the benefits of the modern world too. You kind of have your cake and eat it too. Although it takes a lot of discipline, to pass up that fruit pie in favor of some berries or something. But people do it. I've got a friend who lives down in Cottage Grove, and he's got, he farms 2 acres, he's a vegan, he grows all of his own food, except for some rice and beans that he gets. He uses sawdust from a lumber mill, manure from a friend that keeps horses. It's all organic. And he lives well, and his blood pressure and his stamina and blood sugar, the numbers are unreal. But he also runs on a treadmill in the morning. Why? Because it's pouring down rain, and you don't want to be running out there in the rain. And he mows down the blackberries with a power lawnmower. So I think he has the best of both worlds, it seems to me. But coming back to this idea of truth, it still doesn't mean that truth is relative if the witch doctor really believes in the evil spirits. Doesn't mean that they're evil spirits causing epilepsy. He has a false belief. And you can demonstrate that through, broadly speaking, the scientific method or the application of reason. Thoughts? Comments? Defense of Aboriginal life. I mean, there's something to be said for living close to the earth and eating organic produce and all that stuff too. But I think that doesn't necessarily show. It may be you could say, well, you could put forth a proposition that eating a raw food diet, is more healthy than the standard American diet. And I'd say that would be a true proposition. We're going to talk a little more about the correspondence theory of truth, which is what we've been talking about on Wednesday. We'll also be talking about knowledge. What is knowledge? How is truth related to knowledge? So see if you can get through chapter 1. It's very short. before next time. Books in the LCC bookstore, log in the Moodle, read the syllabus, and I'll see you all on Wednesday.